On today's Friday episode of Nothing Major, we're going to talk about Houston. I'm the only one that did not win this tournament amongst the pod members. We're also going to release our Riley Opelka interview. We filmed this, recorded this, a couple months ago before all the PTPA drama was, came out a couple weeks ago. So just keep that in mind. So with that, let's start our Friday show of Nothing Major. All right, everyone, welcome back. I got John Isner, Jack Sox, Steve Johnson, Charlie Fox, and the team at SIFT. Before we get going right now, in our group chat, we were talking about if guys should shave their armpits or not. getting right into this. John felt very strongly about it. John, should guys be shaving their armpits?
Yes.
I'm with John on this.
Thank you, Stevie.
Well manicured is.
I wasn't ready for that question. I think we're going into this right away, but I think armpit hair is disgusting. And so anyway, what do you think, Sam?
You know, I've been thinking about it for a couple of days. Jack does have hairy armpits.
He does, dude.
Yeah, his hairy armpits like flared out. I was like kind of like, no, you don't need to. But then I've like had a change of heart over the last couple of days. I think they should be like. Shaved, maybe a little bit shaved, like it definitely cleaned up in there.
That's crazy because that's what I do. I do clean it up in there. So apparently I'm either just a caveman or but I do trim it up. So, but thank you for that. It's going to go well on the internet. I appreciate it.
So we're all kind of agreement that the armpits for men should be shavedish.
Yeah.
Well maintained.
Yeah. All right. This is one of the first things we've all kind of agreed on through 50 episodes of this podcast. John, are you a daily shaver of the armpits?
No. I mean, I'm not like Stevie hairy, you know, but you know, keep it.
Is Stevie the hairiest one on the pod?
Mm-hmm. Look at this beautiful beard. Mm-hmm. Might
yeah,
shave
that's
it.
True. It goes Stevie, Jack, me, John, probably.
So Stevie, if you shaved right now, how many days later do you have that big, beautiful beard?
Oh no. Like, I mean, I never shave. Like I just trim, like I never go full shave ever. But I would say I trim it down. This will be like this in 2 weeks.
It's a good effort.
Probably. 2 to 3 weeks. But yeah, it's good for the mustache, you know. It's good for
mustache.
I don't like the way my face feels when I shave. Like I just feel like you're a very clean shaving guy, I feel like every day, and I can't pull that off. Sam tries to grow a mustache, it's the funniest thing I've ever seen. And Jack's got good facial hair. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Jack's got really good facial hair.
I'm more of the faded beard guy, but yeah I don't get
that's
all
a
that
lot of work,
like
though.
You have.
It's just like it's like consistent, like the way it like grows in. It's good.
Do you remember that Davis Cup in Portland? Jack in Portland.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The heartbreaking tie. Yeah.
Yeah. So at that time I was like, I had committed to like growing out my facial hair and I was doing a pretty good job. Like and then I went to a barber in Portland. I just wanted to get it trimmed up. And he gave me like the Jersey Shore, like sharp lines.
The hard line.
Lines. I had worked like 2 months on this thing. Like I had it going. It looked decent. It was something different to do. And he went like Jersey Shore on me and I had to get rid of it all.
Yeah. When you go in, you got to tell them you don't want the hard lines and like you want to keep it looking natural. But your first mistake, going to a barber in Portland.
You didn't go out in public with it, with the Jersey Shore look at all.
No, I did. I think I did. And I was like, maybe it looks okay. And then I think my wife told me it didn't.
This is like a random other question. Do you guys have like a barber at home or like somebody you only see? Like, do you know what I mean?
No, yes. I go to like, Sports Clips.
So like, not that like I have great hair or anything, but like I've had the same guy cut my hair for like 5 years. It's like you just go in there and like you don't have to worry about it. You know what you're going to get.
Jack feels like a high end barber guy.
Yes, absolutely. I'll spend extra dollars to get like a good barber instead of. But yeah, same. I've been using the same guy for probably almost 10 years.
I get my hair cut at Sports Clips every time and I hate how it looks every single time. Just haven't made an adjustment in a decade.
That's bad, Sam. Come on, man.
Those places, you don't have to book. You can just be like on a whim, like, oh, Tuesday at 2:00. I'm going to get my hair cut right now.
Exactly. I mean,
Yeah, exactly.
But you can do a little bit of legwork. I don't get like your...
I don't want to be locked down with a haircut appointment like 3 days in the future.
I'm with you. I'm totally with you, Sam.
What?
You got to get on texting terms with the guy. You got anything open today?
Wait, hold on. I get that from Sam, but from John, who is like very detail-oriented, that surprises me.
No, I... just like the place is close to my house. It's like, all right, I got 30 minutes. I'm like, I'll go try to get a haircut. I call up and ask if I can go in right away. And most of the time the answer is yes. And I show up and I'm back home 20 minutes.
Do you guys ask him to chop up your armpits while you're in there too?
No,
no.
Could wax it though.
Could you imagine you walk in and Izzer shirtless his arm up?
Yeah. Arm up. They finish the hair, like about to take like the bib thing off. You're like, wait 1 second, and just like pull it up and be like, yo, can you just like, can you throw like a tooth?
You know what I
there?
Smell? I smell a Nothing Major wager. You gotta get the armpits waxed.
Oh,
whatever we do, the loser.
God, it hurt.
Laser hair removal on the pits.
All right, let's move on to Houston. We touched on this on the Monday show. It's one of the few events that you have the option as a player of staying in housing around the River Oaks Country Club. These beautiful houses. Some of the houses have guest houses. You stay in them. A lot of us did. Start with Jack. You played Houston, let's say 10 years. Did you stay in a house most of the time or a hotel? And if so, which one did you prefer?
I got lucky pretty early on. I was in, I don't know which year it was, but yeah, in one of my first few years, I got housing like John a little bit. Yeah, this house was just past the courts, and I got to go in to like the side door, and they just made it super easy for me into like basically my own wing of the house, which ended up having a basketball court in it. So I was typically just shooting hoops all day. A drop down projector screen in the living room of like my area that was, I don't even know how big. And we just talked on that usually Masters week. So that was literally my favorite thing ever was practice or play, get back, post up on the couch, watch Masters. But the house was, they had its own church in the backyard.
It was very nice. Yeah,
it was very, very nice house.
John on the Monday show talked about the house he stayed in. Did you feel like there would like word of mouth would go around at Houston? Like, oh, I stayed in a good house. And then players would try to get that house next year, maybe like steal the house from other players. Or did you kind of feel like it was just luck of the draw if you got a good house?
I think once you established that you were staying in a particular home, as long as the family liked you, that was going to be your home for the following year. So I was in a good situation. I've become friends with the family, that the house that I stayed at. So I stayed in there every single year. I think, and I need to ask Tommy Paul this, I think he might be staying there this year. I'm a little jealous.
Are you handing him off? How does that
work?
Yeah,
I actually vouch for Tommy.
You sent like a group text to the house and Tommy, like, hey, like he's looking for a house.
I gave the family a good review on Tommy.
Stevie, you might have stayed in a house only one time. Why are you so grumpy? And then why are you not staying in houses at Houston?
Two, good question. Not that grumpy. Early in my career, I remember, I mean, John always spoke so highly of the housing there, right? You know, and he is right. Like, it is truly incredible. But at that time, I'd played a lot of challengers early in my career where I was staying in housing because, you know, just to save money. And once I got to a tour event, you know, the free hotel room or, you know, whatever it was, like, I was like, I'm going to use the hotel room because I stay in housing a lot of the other times throughout the year if I'm going to go play a challenger. So I wanted to just stay in a hotel kind of deal. And then ultimately, I won a couple of tournaments. I won it twice. So then I just stayed in the hotel. But my last few years, once I had the family started coming, I stayed in a house probably, you know, just down River Oaks Boulevard. You know, I could walk to the courts as well. They were the nicest people. I completely wish 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I would have stayed with them and then just, you know, had that relationship forever because they are the greatest people ever. So I regret it early in my career, but my reasoning was, you know, I was going to go play Sarasota, Savannah, Tallahassee the next 3 weeks and stay in housing. Like, I'm going to stay in a hotel room this week. Like, so I don't have to, you know, be in somebody's living room, basically. So that was my reasoning early on, but I regret it now, especially with the family that I had, which was incredible.
There was always that little bit of risk in Houston. Like, they would find a house for you and like maybe they would give you a bedroom with a twin bed. And like, if you didn't really know the family or have the relationship, there was like that little bit of doubt. And then if you got to a house and it was like, oh, here's a great room for you, and it was a twin bed, you didn't want to be the jerk that would
then leave
the house.
Yeah.
You're kind of like pot committed for the week. But the tournament is incredible. It's River Oaks Country Club, which is arguably one of the, you know, 10 nicest country clubs in the world, probably. It's stunning. The clubhouse, the golf courts. It is beautiful. The vibe. And they open the club up to the players. It's not one of those clubs where it's like, oh, the tennis tournament's going on. Like, make sure you stay in your zoned off sections. Like, they open up the gym, the locker rooms, the pool, the golf course. It is like truly, like, for players, the tennis aside, it's a special week for the players. They have this this massive party on like the Saturday beforehand called the White Party. And it's like it's like a wedding that's on steroids with a band, with a 20-person band. We've all been to it. You got to wear white. Even the players from Europe, you're coming over, you're wearing white. We've all been to it. Jack, have you ever been overserved at the white party? I don't know if you have or not. I'm not proud to call you out. I was just like,
is the way your face froze after you answered that was actually pretty funny. I have not been overserved at the white party. It's a really fun time. The people are incredible. The staff at that club is always like beyond nice as well. That was always warm and welcoming. But yeah, that party, I don't even want to know the dollar amount that they spend on that there at the club. But it's got to be very, very high, and definitely a player event party that will be, I'm sure, we all miss.
A lot of tournaments have player parties in. A lot of the player parties, like a corny little player party, like on a rooftop bar somewhere. But like, this is not that. This is 500 people. I mean, John, you've been a bunch. Like, this was one of those player parties like every player went to. The food is incredible. The drinks were incredible. If you wanted to dance, like, you can go dance. But like, you could dance. Will you ever dance on the dance floor?
Me?
Yeah, you.
No, of course not. I'd have to have a lot of beverages. It's right before the tournament. So you're there. You might, you know, have a beer in your hand like the whole time, but like, you know, that's it. But it's so much fun. Everyone's wearing the white. It's a tradition. They do it every single year, obviously. And it's just, and they built it up year over year, and the players enjoy it.
One of the years, 2010, they had the NCAA March Madness finals in Houston. And John and I actually went to the game. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember. You remember who played?
Duke and Butler.
Yeah. Duke and Butler.
Gordon Hayward missed buzzer beater.
No, it wasn't that one.
Okay.
Good. You got Butler made back to back, right?
Got it. Okay. Finals. Sorry.
We also went 1 year, John.
We did, right? Because I mean, the Houston hosts the Final Four quite often.
Yeah, because we got to like the arena. We got on that like you on that like it was like a, I think it was a, one of those the bike with like the little carriage in the back.
The rickshaw or whatever. Yeah,
yeah. And we got on the back of it. Is there's like falling off? Yeah. And people are walking by. Yeah, it was just.
Yeah, we paid like because we parked far away. Yeah, we went to the semifinal games, and they were both blowouts, and then we missed the UNC-Villanova game, which was like an all-timer. We didn't go back for it on Monday night.
If Isner gets on a rickshaw, you got to tip the guy a little extra just for like grinding like a big body around like that?
Yeah, grinding 230, 40 pounds. I think so, and I think I did. Yeah.
Well, Jack, were you on the rickshaw with him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was sitting right next to him. I got a picture of it.
Yeah, that's like – I hope you guys tip that guy well. That's
not what he was hoping for when he got to work that day.
Houston was always a good tournament because like you would always catch the tail end of March Madness and then the beginning of the Masters tournament would be on as well. So like it was always just like a great vibe in Houston with staying in these unbelievable houses. The club was incredible. Like the tennis venue is great, but then you also have March Madness and the Masters going on. So everyone's won this tournament. John's won it once. Jack's won it once. Stevie's won it twice. I've won it a half of times playing doubles, lost in a couple finals. I'm a little jealous that I'm not in the singles winners club like yourself. Stevie, as the two-time winner, give us the tradition. What is the tradition in Houston when you win the tournament there?
It's a great tradition. You jump into the pool. I think a few of the other tournaments like Barcelona might have it as well, but it is a fun tradition to jump in the pool. I believe John and myself might have two of the worst jumps in the history of River Oaks Pool, like of the history of the event. Cause I think John was cramping or like not feeling well after his title. And certainly after my first title, I was full body cramping in 2017. And to say that I am not a strong swimmer.
I find that so weird, by the way. Do you guys know that? Like Stevie's not a good swimmer.
Yeah.
I'm not meant for the water. I'm not as buoyant. I'm pretty dense. I'm a sinker. It's not good. So like when I jumped in,
clear. I've never met another adult male that doesn't know how to swim.
No, I know how to swim. Like I could stay alive, but like, it's not like I don't feel comfortable. The only time I feel comfortable in a pool is like, if there's a swim up bar, I'll just, you know, wade up there, get a drink and then just go right back to my seat kind of thing. But no, when I jumped in 2017, I basically just fell in. I mean, there was a 75% chance I thought like both legs were going to lock up and like somebody was going to have to come in and save me. And that would have been embarrassing then, but I wish I would have done it because it would be hilarious now, you know, about 8 years later. But it's a great tradition. Just the whole tournament itself is phenomenal. The way they do it, the way they set it up, it's so friendly for the players. It's hard to have a bad time there. The club is so welcoming. The staff, everybody is just phenomenal. And the pool jump, I think, is great. In the last couple of years, the guys have actually gone off the new pool. They have like a 10-foot tall diving board. And like guys have been ripping it off that. So I think it's a great tradition. And I look forward to watching it to some of the guys when they win.
Like I would trade in one of my other titles for a Houston title. Like that one is like a cool one to have. I lost
two 250 titles for one Houston title.
I would trade a...
Like you trade like Vegas and Belgrade.
I'd trade like a Belgrade title in Vegas for a Houston. Yeah, I would. I lost to Cello one year, then lost to Jack one year. Jack, that was your first title, right? Houston?
It was, yep, yep.
Well, you beat me in the final. Going into that final, were you nervous? Not that you're playing me, but just like, was that your first final too?
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so, yeah. I mean, no.
Were you so confident really, you were going to like just
it wasn't. No, it wasn't confident. I just really didn't get like that nervous much playing. Like, pretty loose out there most of the times and just kind of swinging away. That was going to be my game plan going into play you. I think it was maybe our first meeting, and I think the only time we'd practiced in California when I was younger. And I didn't know you obviously that well at that time, so and I had all the respect and for you, but I was I happened to play well. I was fortunate to win that one, but yeah, that I brewed a lot of confidence from that, and I loved playing on clay. So
you already had like a little bit of like an aura around you, like all right, this guy is like good on clay, like his forehand's heavy, got like Rafa RPMs.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously allowed me more time to move even farther left if I wanted and never have to hit my bad backhand. But I was a heavy kick serve guy and then just look for forehands. And especially there at Houston, those courts are so bouncy. And I thrived on it and loved it. So
I remember going into that, like, I know you were like young, hadn't won a title. Like, I was like, oh God, like I'm playing Jack. Like, this is nasty right now. Like, if he gets, once the ball is like on his forehand, like you're on defense the rest of the point. There's no getting out of it.
Yeah.
What year did you guys play? Like 14 or 15?
15.
See, experience does not matter. He was going up against a more experienced player in Sam Querrey. Experience
and just
Grand Slam's different ball game. I've stated this fact.
No, it's not.
But continue. We're not going to go backwards here.
John, give us your best memory in Houston.
The title.
Who'd you beat in the final?
I beat Almagro. And the final was a good win.
Yeah.
I played very well. It was right after, I remember it was after the, we played Serbia in Boise. It was that year, Sam. Remember we played, so we came straight from indoor hard court, like virtually no practice. It was just one of those deals. I kind of just went out there and winged it from the get go. Didn't hit any balls on clay since last year's French Open. And I just botted my way to a title. The balls are really light there. And if it doesn't rain, it's a really fast hard court, which is why you see a lot of big hitters do well there. Ben Shelton won it last year. Riley Opelka beat me in the finals a handful of years ago, which is probably one of the best finals Houston's ever seen, me versus Opelka.
Don't they use a U.S. Open women's ball?
Yeah, it's fast. Like, you can bot. Like, I have crazy. I hit my 10,000th ace against pod member Stevie Johnson sure at did. That tournament. I aced you 3 years ago, Steve, I aced you like 38 times in a three-set match or something. But you can serve massive there. Yeah. Massive. I was just going to say
your serve there was the most
– Yeah.
The worst thing ever to go up against.
Stevie, you've won it twice. You have some great memories. I want your least favorite memory from the Houston event, if you even have one.
I guess a little backstory. You know, to get into slams, you got to be, you know, top 100 or higher, and the ranking system is taken 6 weeks prior to the event. So Houston for us is always like the last tournament we play to get into the French Open. And at the time, I was like 104 in the world, something like that. I needed to make a quarterfinals to be top 100, secure myself into the French, you know, a little bit of a stress relief. So I'm playing John in the round of 16. We're battling, per usual, just grinding it out from the back of the court, 30, 40 ball rallies, you know, the usual. I am serving, I think it was 3-4 in the third. John probably had somewhere north of 15 break points in the match. Never won one. Finally hits like a backhand winner down the line. And all of this ranking like formula is going on in my head. I'm like, if I win this, I'm good, right? Like, I just got to get through John. Somebody who, like, you know, it's not like I'm playing rough out there. No offense. You know, I can get through this match, get a win. So I lose my serve at 5-3 and I absolutely fold a racket over my knee. Like,
obliterated.
Zero, like, just everything kind of hit me. Like, I'm not going to make the French Open. Like, I haven't played a qualifying in a slam in a decade. Like, this is so frustrating to me right now. So I shattered one over my knee, like calmly then walked over, threw it in the trash can. I don't even know why I got a new racket out. I'm pretty sure John just hit four aces. Like, I didn't touch another ball. And the match was over. I walked back in the locker room. I was like, French Open qualies, here we come. And it was just like, I ended up getting into the main. I was the last guy into the main draw like 3 hours before qualies started, or, you know, like the draw closed or whatever. But that was my only, that was my least favorite memory. But it's funny now. Like, it's super funny now because it just is. But that was going through my head in that moment. And John had no idea. So he's like, what is wrong with this guy? Like, he's just going to take a, you know, a loss and we just move on, right? Like, it's no big deal.
I knew you're psycho. You'd do that. I thought it was a normal procedure. I did not know the ranking implications.
I remember I hit a second serve. John hit a backhand winner down the line. And I was like, just please somebody call out, you know, like, please be a mark. And there was just no mark. And I just, that was it.
But you got into the French Open. So all is good.
I did. Yes. Thankfully.
I remember one year, I think it was 2012. At the time I got like the biggest appearance we had ever gotten playing Houston. I went and lost first round. Just like, couldn't have felt like more awful, like for the tournament. Did you guys ever have that? If you got like a good appearance fee somewhere and then you lost first round, like you internally felt bad for the tournament, like you let them down.
Yeah.
For sure. Jack.
Jack can elaborate on that a little more.
I had one bad year in Auckland that I regret acting.
Yes. 2018.
Yeah, it was the year after I won it. And I got an appearance fee, I think, or whatever, they rolled out the red carpet, you know, maybe a small appearance fee. And I,
you were seven in the world.
Auckland. Yeah. It was the year. Yeah. I started the year at eight and was down there, the one seed, literally just played the year end finals a month and a half prior, whenever it is. And, I went down and I acted like an idiot. I was also given false information about the schedule that like really irritated me, and it was like the complete opposite of what they had promised and told me. So, as you guys know, I like to play as late as possible and start the tournament as late as possible, and they went the opposite way, and I felt rushed, and I went out and lost to somebody that you don't think you should lose to, and then kind of got into it with the tournament director after. I apologize. And he had just paid me to come down there. So not the best look overall.
When I in Houston, the year I lost, I ended up losing to Ryan Sweeting, who went on to win the tournament. But I kind of did the same thing where like, I got a big fee and I feel like I didn't act that great on the court and maybe like pouted in. Like I felt terrible.
Yeah.
I actually think I gave half the fee back because I felt
very noble of you.
Not to toot my own horn, but like I felt so bad about like my behavior and stuff on the court that it.
Yeah, it's tricky though. I mean, you can't control how you play. Like, if you play poorly, it's one thing.
I regret it. I want that actually. That with that half back, Houston. Sorry, go ahead, Steve.
I mean, no, but if you play poorly, that's one thing. Like, you know, that happens.
Yeah.
But like,
yeah.
If you have a bad attitude, that's when you feel like you've let somebody down. Like, you can't control how you play out there, but
right, you can control your attitude.
Correct.
John, best. You ever have a tournament? You got a good fee and like lost early and.
Certain I have.
And felt bad about it. Or are you just like, no, that's part of doing business at these tournaments. Like Stevie said, you can go there and try hard and lose and there's no hard feelings. Like that's just how it works.
I lost to a guy who gets mentioned on our pod quite a bit. I lost to Raidu Albot, an indoor court in New York.
Jack's boy.
Jack's boy. And I think maybe it was one of the top two seeds that, you know, that year at the tournament. So, but for sure, it puts a little extra pressure on you. Like, you know, the tournament is investing in you to sell tickets, to promote the tournament. And it puts a little pressure on you to feel like you at least need to make the weekend semis or the finals. And if you don't do that, you feel like you're letting the tournament down because they're taking a risk on you.
Especially these 250s. Like they're the ones that have more to risk. And like, you know, they might pay one or two guys like a good amount. And like, you feel like as one of those guys, if you get it, like, yes, you deserve, I got to make it till Friday or Saturday. Wow. This got kind of serious, but,
We're a
serious podcast. Yeah. All right. We got, Riley Opelka interview airing right now. Again, we filmed this 6 weeks ago before all the PTPA, drama came out. So let's get to our Riley Opelka interview.
All right, everyone. We are excited to be joined right now by Riley Opelka. He has a career high rank of 17. He is the junior serve bot of the group here. And most importantly, he is a non-major winner and probably the number one art aficionado on the tennis tour. So with that, I'd like to welcome Riley Opelka.
Thank you, Stevie.
Clap it up.
All right, Riley, we're going to kind of start back in the early days, start in your junior days. We've had a couple of your junior compatriots on the podcast already. They've given us some silly answers, but let's start with you first and foremost. What age did you realize that you were never going to win a rally over five shots?
21.
Oh, wow.
It took me a while. Yeah, it took me a while to embrace the bot life.
So what turned for you in the bot life?
I was tired of playing challengers in Central America. And then that's when I gave in. Obviously, you know, playing with Tommy and Fritz and those guys, I was not terrible as a junior, and I won plenty of junior tournaments not botting. And then it's quite hard to, like, you know, jump up a couple levels when you turn pro, and then you just have to embrace that that's going to be what it takes to win. It's not what it was your whole life.
Yeah, no doubt. We've asked Taylor and Tommy, you boys grew up down in Florida together. Who out of the three of you guys back in the day when you were growing up, who did you guys think was the best? Who was the worst?
We all fluctuated, but Tommy was definitely the most consistent. Like, Tommy won gold balls in the 12s, 14s, 16s, 18s. Like, he was hands down the most consistent. There were better guys than him that kind of, you know, disappeared at some point. But Tommy, I would say, was like the best junior overall.
And then just for a little bit of context here, we have two of the greatest servers of all time. So I'm going to go to the GOAT bot first. You guys talk about serve bot. You guys put the bot emoji, you know, on socials all the time. John, can you give the listeners a brief explanation of what a serve bot is?
Actually, Riley put it best a handful of years ago. He said a bot is someone that's miserable to watch. And I think he hit the nail on the head there.
Yep.
And I think a lot of tennis fans that serve kind of came about in the last 10, 15 years. And it was a definite dig at tall players with really good serves. And Riley and myself, I think especially Riley, kind of flipped it around and used it as a term of endearment in a sense. So really embraced the bot lifestyle and the bot emoji, especially, that a lot of people use. So again, I think, as I said, Riley said it best, miserable to watch. And when Riley and I have played each other, or two bots go up against each other, we kind of make fun of that match. We talk about how amazing the match is going to be, which is going to be anything but. So we embrace it that way. We sort of change the narrative on the bot. And I think because of that, I think a lot of fans have started to endear themselves to bots a lot more.
Yeah, I think Kyrgios was a big kind of eye-opener for John and I in the bot category, because we had thought that it was someone that just didn't break serve often. But then we were watching Nick play, and he had, you know, full house and obviously a line wrapped around the court twice to watch him. But he's a bot. It's just, he's not miserable to watch.
Exactly.
And so that's where I made the discovery that is the true definition of a bot. They have to be, not only do they have to break serve very rarely, they also have to be miserable to watch.
I can watch you guys serve all day. I think it's highly enjoyable just to see other players get frustrated walking back and forth just for 2 hours, just getting ace left and right. But so Riley, kind of going back to the juniors, at what age did you feel like this was actually going to be a viable option for you? Being a professional tennis player, was it a coach? Was it a moment in your career, you know, junior slams, et cetera, that kind of kickstarted you into being a professional tennis player?
It was definitely Jay Berger, who was the head of men's tennis when I was a junior. You know, he worked with all of us, me, Tommy, Taylor, Francis, and there was plenty of times where I'd fallen behind in the group. And Jay was always the one that always shot everyone straight, whether you liked it or not. We were pretty intimidated by him. He was kind of the, you know, the hard ass of a coach, let's call it. But he, you know, I think his belief in me was, gave me a lot of confidence as a junior when I wasn't nearly, you know, one of the best. I'd fallen quite far behind in that group with me, Tommy, and Francis and Taylor and Michael Moe. I mean, those guys were like playing in the ITS when I was still playing in like the USTA tournaments.
Speaking about Taylor, Tommy, and Francis, what I find truly remarkable with you guys, I mean, you guys have all lived together, you've grown up together, your experiences outside of the tennis court couldn't be more vastly different from one another, your hobbies, your interests. How does that look in a house? I know you spent a lot of time, you know, living with Tommy, living with Taylor. Like, how does that look inside of a house for you guys, like with your hobbies being so incredibly different from one another?
You know, there was a time when me, Tommy, and Taylor were all staying at my house some point in the pandemic. And, you know, it was just funny. Like, I see like three computer monitors, not like laptops, like computer monitors set up on my kitchen table. And I was like, where did these even come from? And Fritz like travels with two of them, and then he bought another one so he could like game. And then, you know, you got a couple, you know, open a couple bottles of a couple cans of beers laying around next to it. That's definitely Tommy watching Taylor play video games. And then there's like, you know, a painting in the right behind it. And I remember literally in the pandemic, I was like, wow, this couldn't define us more right now. We got gaming monitors, some beers, and some art.
This must have been like 6 years ago. Fritz had me bring, he like left a bag somewhere, like let's call it like Houston or something. And I had to bring it home for him. Of course, I like snooped and opened the bag. And it was like three gigantic monitors for like gaming. Bag weighed like 90 pounds.
he's hardcore.
Yeah, Riley. So you have played all of us, you know. A couple of us only one time. The one that stands out, you have a 5-1 record against the GOAT bot, John Isner. You guys have played 16 sets, and surprisingly, only three of which didn't go to a tiebreak. Thoughts on playing another serve bot? Clearly, you didn't have any issues playing the GOAT serve bot. How was it playing the big guy, getting a bit of a taste of your own medicine? Did you enjoy that?
I mean, it was a tough one just... obviously because John had so many match points, it could easily be the other, you know, 5-1 the other way because there was all tiebreakers.
Such a bot.
You know, a lot of them were really good matches. I actually always served way better than my average when I played John. I think like, I don't know what it was, just, you know, I always grew up watching John. John was my favorite player as a kid. And so I think I had stress.
No. There's no lying. Shot that John is your favorite player as a kid.
Swear.
Thank you, Sam.
Yeah, I watched him play. I watched him play Cincinnati against Igor Andreev when I was like, is that right, John?
Play him there a long time ago.
Yeah. And I think you were like just, you know, freshman on tour, first year, second year. And you totally bothered the guy.
I
root for all the Americans, of course, but I have signed keychain from Sam Querrey, actually.
No way. That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
I know.
You still have them?
No.
He uses the first
card. Exactly.
No.
Oh, come on.
No, I don't have it, but I know for a fact I did. And actually, I actually had beef with Sam because I got this sick white, beautiful RF hat right when the RF logo kind of came out, and it was gold, and I got an RF logo that Captain Goalie bought for me at Cincinnati, and then I didn't ask Sam to sign it at all because I didn't want anyone to sign it because it was brand new, and Sam signed it.
What are you talking about right now? Dude, like, you're just walking by and signed your hat?
Yeah, because Goalie, I think, was there. I don't know. We met in the players' lounge. Right. And then,
such
and then
a the Sam guy, move.
The guy kind of assumed I wanted him to sign my hat, and he signed my hat.
Sam, you just ruined that.
My bad. Sorry.
I wanted Fed to sign it.
And he got a Querrey signature on a Fed hat.
Don't look too close.
Brutal. Yeah. Riley, remember a long time ago, we at the U.S. Open, you were a junior. You must have been 16 or 17. We practiced on those, like that row of five courts.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I was just saying, God, you're a bot, dude. Like, total bot. You were so tall and skinny, but you had an unbelievable backhand. And we share the same agent, me, you, and Stevie do, and Sam Duvall. And I actually knew then that you were going to be a very, very good player, because for a guy your size, I know we're miserable to watch.
you and yeah. I.
You guys aren't that miserable to watch, by the way. Like, you got, like I always say, John's got best drop shot on tour, got great touch.
I do.
Like,
right, Jack?
Opelka, when Opelka beat Djokovic this year, you were beating him from the ground.
We're the same size. Like, Riley, you are incredibly fast. And for our listeners out there, here's what I want to, because we've asked Tommy and Taylor this, in a 100-yard dash, 100-yard straight line, 100-yard sprint, is there anyone on tour faster than you, in your opinion?
Than me?
Yes. If there are, how many are there?
I definitely beat up on Tommy and Taylor.
Long strides.
I think Query in his day, Sock is a joke. Sizz is unbelievable. Crazy explosive. I don't know if I'm beating Sock. In a 40, I'm definitely not beating Sock.
Not in a 40, yeah.
In 100 right now, just so you know, like at least Isner and I think you're the fastest player on tour currently.
Yeah, Malfiz would probably be a nightmare.
No, that's the fall. That's such a lazy answer. That's the fallback for everything athletic.
I'm with you, Sam.
If people are like, oh, who's the best at this? Everyone just says Malfiz.
I think it's you, Riley. I don't think there's anyone beating you in 100. Dude.
Yeah, 100, I'm not bad.
You're the guy.
So I'm just saying, we're not going to stop crowning you here, but for someone almost 7 feet tall, you move around the court and straight line, side to side, incredibly well. But let's talk about, like, I have my answers for this, but I want to ask you, the advantages and the disadvantages of being a bot. We know about the advantages, so I'm not going to go into that.
It's singular.
Okay, yeah, the advantage for being a bot. Well said, well put. What about the disadvantages? And do you think bots don't get enough respect? Because a lot of people think what we do on the tennis court as bots is really easy. Stevie Johnson in particular is one. And it always annoyed me. So tell us about the travails that us bots face on tour on the tennis court.
Purely from a numbers game, the average height of the top 10 is definitely nowhere near 6'11.5". I would say it's quite the opposite. It's closer to 6 foot. The average Grand Slam winner's height is definitely under 6'3", 6'2". And I think that you could easily make the argument if I was like 6 inches shorter, I'd be a lot better. I think John could easily say the same. He could get down to the lower ball easier. Like, I don't know, just, you know, as you guys know, it's also like a lot of it's just finding ways to win. John was unbelievable at that. Just, he could play matches where he would make 4 or 5 shots max, but he'd still beat a top 10 player. And that's not.
What a backhanded compliment. I love it.
Well, I mean, it's not just about, obviously you have to serve well to be able to do that, but there is an element of knowing how to win. And if you give John, you know, you give him 7 inches closer to the ground, he's probably going to be a pretty good mover. And he's also going to be able to figure out his game and figure out how he wants to compete and put guys under pressure the same way he did at 7 foot. But the biggest disadvantage is traveling.
Yep, for sure. That was actually going to be my next question. Explain to people how miserable traveling is. And for me, it wasn't necessarily the airplanes. It was more the cars at tournaments, in particular Europe.
Yeah.
And the hotels in Europe, not the hotels in Asia. Those are made amazingly for big guys. Like everything's grand and massive in Asia, right? Am I right? Like the hotel beds, the elevator doors, but you get to Europe and the elevators are this big and the frame is like 6'2", completely miserable. Talk a little bit about it, Riley.
Europe needs a big iOS update for sure. It's super old. And then the cars. Yeah. I mean, the worst possible tournament setup for me is when you're in Europe in a small, remember when they were Peugeot, I couldn't even get in the door. Like just getting in was like, I'd like crawl in and like, it was crazy just getting in. But I think that if you have to drive like 25 minutes from the hotel to the courts, your back, your neck, like everything is so stiff. And then you have to get there an hour and a half before your 1 hour warm up just to undo that car ride.
I'm saying like, I have a hard time getting out of those cars at like 6'2". Like I know, like I give John a lot of crap on this podcast, like, and in general, I know what they do is very hard, and like the travel must be miserable. Cause if I'm miserable, they got another foot on me. So like, it has to be bad.
Yeah, it's rough. And then also like, I don't know if you do this, John, but when you're flying overseas on the lay flat, I kind of recently discovered this where I lay it flat, but then I sit like all the way at the head, the headrest, and then my back's like against like the back part. My legs are straight.
That's a good idea.
It's actually that's a nice hack. I'm going to try that if I ever go to Europe again.
Yeah, it's a good hack for bots.
Yeah, I can't. The lay flat is like, Sam, could you lay flat completely?
I was like, right, like some I could and some I had to have like a slight knee bend.
Yeah.
You know, they went to like 6'5".
Yeah, that's nice.
About 6'5". It's about 6'5". Yeah. So I was never able to lay flat. I had to just tilt it and then I basically would sleep upright, kind of like that. But that's a nice little hack there, bot.
It's a good hack. Query, by the way, Query is kind of he had the antidote for bots.
Yeah, I was a good returner against bots.
Yeah, and he could serve, like hold serve against us just as easy as we could against him. And he's a much better athlete than a bot. And then his running forehand is pretty ridiculous. So like,
thank you. Keep going.
Passing shots. I thought you were a bad matchup for a bot. Guys like you, Chilich, and like Delpo, like the longer the reach, the more balls you can put in play.
Totally.
Yeah. Medvedev's the worst. Is there anyone better at playing bots than Medvedev?
No, he's really brutal.
I think he's the ultimate antidote. I always said Stevie J was a tough matchup for bots because he would hold serve well and he can have that chip return, which is really effective.
I would just gross it out if I made it in.
Yeah, Stevie J enjoyed playing bots. He enjoyed playing me. I don't know how many times you guys played, but he did not mind playing bots. But that's a perfect segue, Riley, for my next segment. And I'm going to close it out with this. We're going to play a little game called Bot or Not. Mm. So here we go. We'll start with the top of the list. Me, bot or not?
Bot.
Thank you. All right. Sasha Zverev, when his serve is rolling, bot or not?
Total bot.
Oh, you give him a bot.
I give him bot. Yeah.
Dude, he's serving like 75% on the year.
No, I understand.
He's the number one server.
But he's breaking serve at like 28% as well. Okay. All right. Fair enough. This is Riley's game. Ben Shelton.
Bot.
I only want one more answer. Actually,
Ben's tough though because he. Ben.
He's not miserable to watch.
He's not miserable to watch. No, Zverev's like, I don't mean it. It's not like he's people watch him just because he's so good, and he competes like an absolute dog. You know, one of the best competitors I've ever seen. So, but I don't know if he was like, you know, if he was. It's hard to say, but if he's not 2 in the world, if he's 12 in the world, is he selling as many tickets? I don't know. Because he's kind of a bot.
Milos Raonic.
Yeah, bot.
All right, Nick Kyrgios. You spoke about earlier. Nick Kyrgios.
Him and Ben we have to have like a separate category for them.
They challenger rely on bot.
Their serve. They rely hybrid on their serve bot. More than, yeah. Yeah, they're like a bootleg bot, but in a good way.
Yeah,
not
because
like
they have flair. They
like
have flair.
What about a bougie bot?
Yeah, because they serve incredibly well, and if you take that away from them, you know that's 90% of their game. But they sell a bunch of tickets.
Okay, all right, Sam Querrey.
Bot.
I love it.
It's such an insult for some reason.
It is. This is what I've dealt with for 18 years on tour.
Yeah,
thank you.
Insult.
Yeah. Welcome. Yeah. Welcome to our miserable world.
Yes. Yeah, Sam hit 10 aces in a row.
Yeah. You do hold the record for that. Yeah.
Yes. True. He set the record. True. Hubert Hurkacz.
Bot.
I agree. Kevin Anderson.
Bot.
Chris Eubanks. This is the best game I've ever played. All right. Alexander Bublik.
Bot.
But he's in that, he's like a bootleg bougie bot, right?
Yeah.
He's got a lot of flair.
Yeah, he's got a lot of flair. He does have a lot of flair. But
wait, I mean, can you be a bot if you go underhand serve? Like, you would have never done that in your career.
I was going to say, is underhand serving bot-like?
So I'm saying, but that's our point. He's our bot with flair.
Yeah, he's a bot with flair.
That's our point. Yeah. Two more for you. I think I know the answer to this one. Daniil Medvedev.
Not a bot.
Finally
got not a bot. And the last one, Riley Opelka.
Bot. Bot.
That's it. That was a great game.
That was a great game.
Thanks for playing along, Riley. That's all I got for you.
When Med was one in the world, he was a bot. That was what made Med so brutal. He would hold serve just as fast as me, John, or Nick, but then his return games, you know, he could drag them out against me. They'd be, I'd feel like I was holding serve in 10 minutes if I was even holding, and he was holding in 60 seconds.
At least the other guys that you like, most of them have nice service motions. Medvedev, like all of his strokes are just like, it's hard to watch.
He makes up for it in the presser after every single time.
Oh, dude, he's the best. We're trying to get him on the pod. We can't get him on the pod. I don't know.
He's unbelievable.
Like, we want him on so bad. If you see him next
the casino,
week,
the line he did with after he won his first round of the Australian Open.
Yeah.
For me, that's probably the best interview ever in tennis.
All right, that's it for Riley. We got part two of this interview next week. It's a great interview, a long interview, so make sure you tune into that. Before ending the show, we're going to roast a fan again. Fans have been sending in their tennis videos, and we will roast it. If you're listening on audio, this will not make a lot of sense. So you can go watch on YouTube, but if you're still listening on audio, maybe it'll be funny. I don't know, but it's way funnier if you go to YouTube and watch. So let's get to this video. This fan video is from Kevo. It says, please roast my game. I'm a full-time dad now. He's got a baby who's 9 months old, so he doesn't have time to train and play. He's also dealing with a back injury, not from tennis, but from lifting the baby in strollers. A lot of complaints from this guy. Not training. So what is, like, if you didn't have a baby, are you like training? Are you a pro? Like, what? I don't get it. But anyway, let's check out the video.
Dude.
Yes.
I mean, I don't, like, what are you supposed to say? I
don't want to play him in a baseline game.
No, he chops you up.
Yeah.
He's got a little alligator arms on the forehand.
A little T-Rexy on that. Also, I can't take him serious wearing pants.
Yeah,
exactly. If you're playing in pants, you're not a serious player.
It looks like you got those like TJ Maxx and like the clearance rack. Like the
this
old
looks like, by the way, like pants. Every practice facility in Europe.
Yes.
Every single one.
Every single practice place building, you ever went to. Yeah.
The building, exactly. Yeah.
I honestly think if you would have given us like four guesses, like where is this? I think someone would have said Romania.
Yeah, Bucharest.
Yeah.
But you're right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
He just looks like a big tryhard, and I just whatever.
Look, hold on. If you pause it there, he's got the query left hand on the forehand.
Maybe he mirrors his game after mine.
He can make two finals in Houston.
All right. As always, go to the link on our page, nothingmajorshow.com, if you want to submit questions or anything. Also, we're on YouTube if you want to watch our beautiful faces while we chat and yell at each other. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, at Nothing Major Show. Go check it out. We appreciate all the support. Like our stuff. Follow us. We need subscribers, guys. We need them. So, no, we don't really need them. We're doing well. I don't want to sound desperate. We're doing all right. But we still want them. So we'll see you guys next Monday.